Hi, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Bureshi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week we invite a writer from the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book on to discuss their article in the book. And this week we have the wonderful Pip War.
Hello. It's nice to be here. Love what you've done with the place.
Thank you very much for joining us. Firstly, just for the benefit of listeners who might not know your name or your illustrious career in games, which has spanned multiple sectors, could you give us a quick outline of who you are and what do you do?
Ooh, so I am a writer and narrative designer, and I mostly spend my time consulting on games for other people and trying to bring what they want it to say into an actual wrangleable format, I would say, is the main thrust of it. And then there's all these other twiddly bits that I can't help but stick my fingers into the pies of and mess around with, but you know, that's usually ancillary to all the writing stuff.
Okay, so a many-edged narrative designer interfacing with the project in every way that you're allowed to do. Excellent.
Yes, a meddler, I think.
A meddler of writing. We like that. Pip, we will kick off the podcast talking about your article, if that's okay. Your article is titled Localization, Localization, Localization. And we are quite excited to do this because we haven't yet been able to cover this topic on the podcast. Would you mind giving us a summary of the article, your thesis there, and what you would like to convey to anyone who hasn't read it?
I think so it came about because I was knee deep in a localization process at the time. So it felt like the thing that was closest to the surface for me. And then it also struck me that it's a part of game development that is often invisible, I would say, to players or to, you know, people outside the industry, apart from, you know, the questions of why isn't this in my language, or, you know, could you just, you know, or why did this translation read a bit weird? You know, you sort of notice it when it is going a bit strangely, or you notice it when it hasn't been done and it's impeding your access to something. So I wanted to dig in and also to gather my thoughts on the things that one needs to do in order to get a good result, having worked on some quite complicated games to localize.
So I think the thing that really struck me about your article, for people who haven't read it, is that it's surprisingly joyful, actually. Like it reads as a sort of celebration of the localization process and of the joy of the diversity of languages and cultures and all the different inflections that they bring. And I was just saying to Saga before the podcast started, at Inkle, we don't do any localizations. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But one of them is that it's really, really hard to do. It's really hard. And programmers complain about it all the time. And narrative designers complain about it. And generally, it's considered to be this economic necessity, but I feel like it's often considered to be just this burden. But your article didn't give that impression at all. It gave this impression as you saw it as a kind of opportunity for making your game, I don't know, better or more interesting to more people. And like, I really liked that. But I kind of wanted to ask, do you feel that joyous about the job of can you bring that much positivity to this process? Like, sell it to me, come on.
Like, John's internal skepticism coming out. Yes,
I'm sorry, I'm trying to phrase this as nicely as I can.
I mean, it also took me by surprise because I reread the piece in advance of this podcast, and I was sort of like, oh, I've mentioned staring into the abyss a fair few times, you know, like, was I having a crisis that day? You know, how was I? Oh, dear. So the fact that it did manage to transmit something of the fascination I have with the process is very reassuring to hear, actually. I think that it's where I get the joy from. It is the communication element. It's the fact that I find language endlessly fascinating as a tool and as a thing that that we are constantly playing with and adapting, and that branches off in strange ways depending on who you're around or the way that your entire sort of culture is set up. And I really enjoy thinking about the stuff that I'm trying to say in a different way, and I hope that isn't particularly navel gazy. It's more a kind of, you know how you think that you've done one thing and then you find out as you interrogate it, oh, okay, I didn't even realize that I'd been thinking about this other thing that I've brought into the process, or I was riffing on a particular pun that only works because if it, or rather that only works if you have these shared reference points. And so what is it that was intrinsic to the point I was trying to make, and what can actually just be thrown up in the air if it's a better translation of that core feeling or that core intention by a wonderful translator who just sort of goes, okay, you need to tell the person to go over here. So all of this faff that you've added, you know, that is the thing that has to remain. And if we don't get the reference to, I don't know, Hollyoaks in the 90s, that's fine. That is not the thing that we're 100% ultimately trying to communicate with people.
So go ahead.
I just had a quick follow-up to that. Would it be fair to say that you think that maybe this localization process, this interrogation of what you've written, makes you a better writer because it forces you to actually reflect on things that you might otherwise include in quite a throwaway way? Is that a fair comment, do you think?
So I think that this is my two types of writer theory for when I write an airport bestseller and just fully cash out, you know. But I do think that there's something in it. The idea that there are people who approach writing as a kind of an uncontrollable font of ideas. You know, it's this thing where you are super creative from the act of writing. You need to get your ideas down. You want to explore things as you sort of go through that first draft. And then there are people like me who are far more editors. You know, it's like pulling teeth to get a first draft out of me. And then as I try and figure out what the thing was or how to make it good, that's the part that energizes me. And it's also the part that meant that I really enjoyed my time as deputy editor at PC Gamer, because it was all about looking at what somebody had submitted and then figuring out, okay, well, how do I get them to say it better, or how do I look at what they've done and draw out all of the really cool things that they're trying to communicate within this word count that they haven't stuck to in any way, shape or form. So I think that as somebody who finds that part of the process really rewarding, and more so than the initial draft, that's where my real enthusiasm and my curiosities really come into play and start to vibe with that whole process. Whereas I'm wondering whether you would fit more into the first camp, John, where you would sort of be the person who genuinely enjoys writing, and, you know, so the other stuff is a bit of a, yeah, but I've done the fun bit, you know, why do I have to do this bit now?
I mean, to be honest, actually, when I'm writing, I do try to be quite kind of deconstructy about it. You know, that thing of, oh, this is, why am I using this sentence structure? Oh, it's because it reminds me of a line of dialogue from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Is that a good reference here or not? You know, that kind of thing. And like, where does this rhythm come from? But I do find that I also have quite a low ceiling of tolerance for it because I get very bored after a while. You know, when you're changing it from the one present tense to the other kind of present tense. I went to a comprehensive school in Manchester, so I don't know any grammar words, but I know there's two kinds of present tense and I flip between them going, it's that one. No, it's that one. No, it's that one. Oh, I don't even care anymore. And cut the whole line. And that's my process. So it's not very scientific. But yeah, that's really, it's really interesting, actually. I love it when people describe their kind of, I don't know exactly the word for it, their methodology, basically, their craft process.
The framework. Like how do they,
because so often writing is described as this thing where a writer sits down and then they black out for 3 hours and then they've got a fully finished document and they go, right, off to the pub. And like somehow that has never vibed with my experience of being a writer. And it always annoys me when people talk that way. So it's lovely to hear something more specific and detailed.
And I actually think you can have that sense of sort of intellectual focus, I guess, on the writing, of being aware of the sentences you're doing, whether you are in camp one or camp two of what you laid out, Pip, right? But it does strike me that if you have a bit of that editor's mindset, you will likely have more of a sense of an overview of what's happening. And that might not be true, of course. Please correct me if so. And if that is the case about localization, I wonder whether there is a particular danger that we can get into, because I sympathize, of course, with all of the things you've said. Like, I have been filling in that spreadsheet and seen my like note to translator be way bigger than like anything else that's in the row, right? Like I totally get this feeling, because you're like, there's nuance here. You can do it or you cannot do it, but if you're doing it, at least do it properly, you know, whatever it is. However, is there a problem of being too aware of the localization process and then reducing your text to a lowest common denominator? In other words, like, it is almost always true that they're in a line of dialogue, you want something characterful and something maybe mechanical or something practical to be transmitted. And it's almost always going to be easier to reduce it down just to the latter. And if you do that in every circumstance, do we risk having a game where it's like a manual, like a series of instructions, and we sort of lost everything? How do you approach that?
So I think that localization, as with any part of game development, has to fit in around so many things that answers are usually really complicated and tied to the other constraints on a project. So for example, I would say that if left to my own devices and given enough time and coffee, I would probably have one of those overrunning explanations next to every single thing, just to make sure that I'd expressed myself correctly to my satisfaction. But often you will actually get quite close to the end of the project and someone will say, if we don't send it to localization now, we won't get it back in time.
Yeah.
And so you'll be working to a particular time constraint, so that might mean that you prioritize things very differently. You might be a contractor who doesn't then get to have the direct conversation with the people who are doing the translations, and therefore there needs to be a bit of, well, at least could you pass this on, you know, after the thing has gone to them. There's also the fact that something that I find very useful is being able to send documents that I've in theory been updating over the course of game development, but often have forgotten about entirely and have been up all night rewriting, about, you know, characters and about settings or about particular turns of phrase that are kind of IP within the game to explain what that is, or, you know, to allow a translator to make a decision on, oh, we just won't localize that at all. It just will be the English phrase of this because it's a brand name and that's fine, you know, or it doesn't quite work the way that we would do it otherwise. So I don't know if that's a useful thing to put back to you for this question, but I think that ultimately, especially because it has to happen pretty much last on the narrative side of things. It's in this squeezed time space often. And so you have to make so many little decisions about what to prioritize. And so that does, you know, for better or worse, tend to stop you getting into the total over-explaining category and push you far more towards, well, at least know this one thing.
Right. Yes, I see. Okay, so I think, given what you've just said there, and because you talked about this in the article, I wonder if it would be a good time for you to explore how you did localization in the two titles that you referred to, because I feel like A Monster's Expedition is a particularly tough challenge in which to do this, and given the subject and the setting of the archaeology you had here. Little Kitty, Big City as well, but you're also working with a developer that's overseas, right? So, I mean, you have different relationships in all of these scenarios with how English itself is structured, don't you, right?
Yeah. So with the Monsters Expedition, all of the exhibits within the game's strange museum spread across multiple tree island things, they are all so rooted in this slightly askew version of England that is the sort of thing that you would encounter in Midsummer Murders probably and very few other places. It's sort of a church fate come to life and slightly mutated, and so that in itself was an interesting mindset to be in for the writing, and also with working with colleagues who, some of whom were based in the UK and, you know, got some of where I was coming from without needing to translate it for themselves. And then we also had, for example, Seren, who was a producer on the project, and she is very much not from the UK. She's an American, and was sort of every now and again just saying, what even does this mean? What is a jammy dodger? Like, why, what is happening right now? And so it was, there were a lot of little moments where there were things which I hadn't necessarily even thought of as being particularly regional, would get thrown back to me, and I would have a little bit of a, oh, okay, yeah, no, this is baked so deeply in that I do it even when I wasn't meaning to. And the same thing actually happened with Little Kitty, because I made the mistake of saying out loud, I don't actually think I write in a particularly British way. And I think that Matt, who is the lead and the studio owner, guffawed at me.
As John and I are doing right now.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, exactly. Hate to pigeonhole your work.
Like me, a person who says, gosh, you know, in seriousness, thought that, no, I don't have a particularly English way of saying things. So, you know, that's all fine. I feel like I've gone on a bit of a wander with this explanation. What was the question?
No, it's quite relevant.
Well, I have a specific question about Little Kitty, Big City, actually. It's one of my kids' favourite games, actually. He's played through it at least three times at this point. What country is it supposed to be set in? Like, in your head, what country is this? Like, in my head, it's Australia, but I have no idea if that's accurate or not.
That's so interesting. So it is aesthetically, it's a highly fictionalized version of Tokyo, actually. The game objects, like, and the ways that the houses are set up were inspired by people's visits to that region, and like the fascination with like the relationship with cats and stuff, mm-hmm. and so there's a lot of that in there. But then you add this layer of, I guess, just how I naturally talk or write, which is mediated through other people and their feedback, but ultimately you kind of can't help who you are as you write. So that does push the game in a particular direction. And so it's really interesting to hear you say that Australia is the sort of where it landed for you, because I do think that there's a, in my head, I associate stop-offs in Japan with the friends that I have from Australia who make that sort of that hop as they're going home. And so maybe there was something dialogue and object mashup that was doing that for you.
I think for me, Australia might be my go-to bucket for things which are British but not British. It's like, if you're uncannily British, then you're probably Australian. Like, you know, in 50 years' time when there's a Mars colony, I'll be listening to like broadcasts from them going, nah, it's just Australia, isn't it? Like, it's totally a fake.
That also that accent thing that you get with whenever I go to America, it's kind of, are you Australian? Are you South African? Are you, you know?
I am embarrassed. I'm embarrassed for my country retrospectively.
Yeah, absolutely. America is definitely not British, but not British. It's British.
Yes, that's right.
Long gone, I'm afraid. But I think what you mentioned about the kind of your personality coming through the writing, I think that's really interesting, actually. And that reminded me of something that I wanted to ask about, which was, so as you're in this localization process, as you're approaching this localization process, it feels to me like there's a question there about the intention of a localization. Like, is the intention to communicate the regionality that you'd originally intended? So if you're localizing Monsters Exposition, do you basically want to start teaching Italian and French and Dutch people about what Britishness is like? Like, should we say jammy dodger and then have in brackets an explanation that it is a biscuit with jam in the middle? Or are we trying to like create a sort of an acceptable clone of the game that slots into that world elegantly? And I guess it depends on the project. Like, if you're writing Fortnite, you probably want it to be buttery smooth to everyone in the world, right? But your projects are, I mean, the sort of project that you've been working on are presumably projects you've been hired to work on because people like your voice and they don't want to sand the edges off it and make it disappear into the substrate. The reason that I ask, actually, is because I was recently watching the American version of the TV sitcom Ghosts. And the British version is phenomenally well written. And the American version is absolutely appallingly written, but they are clearly the same program. And it's a fascinating example of, like, is this a good localization or a bad one? Because I think it's very popular in America. They clearly knew what they were doing, but it's also terrible.
For you out of interest?
In the American Ghost.
What do you think they should have taken from the UK version?
So I don't know what they... Well, I mean, I think they should have just played the UK version in America, to be fair. It's my simple hot take on that. But like, I think what I really noticed about it was that all the subtext is drifted up into text throughout the show. People are constantly telling you exactly what they think and exactly what they feel, the main characters and the ghosts alike. They're saying things like, we should do this because I feel like this about this. And like, but the whole ghost is a character comedy, right? The whole comedy of it is the fact that each of these characters can't help themselves, and we know what they're like and they know what they're like, but we don't talk about it, which is perhaps a very British joke in its structure. I'm not sure, but
I haven't seen the show, but I feel like I should, because it could be that, like, for you, what has been brought up into text still seems subtextual to the American audience, right?
To the casual American audience.
Or is it just so obvious that it's
audience,
like, maybe, right?
I mean, I don't know. And obviously I was watching the two side by side. Basically, my kids are big fans of Ghosts, so we thought we'd try the American one because we'd finished the British one. We watched about 15 minutes. My kids were like, turn it off, you're ruining everything. They had this wonderfully, wonderfully large reaction to it. But I didn't think they were wrong, to be fair. Anyway, there was a question in there. So, Pip.
There was.
Yes. How do you approach this?
So, I think... I'm also trying not to go too far down the rabbit hole of imagining what an American's experience of the UK version would be like, given what you just said, because it's like, so do they just think that, like, it's a bunch of people talking about completely unrelated subjects and then getting sort of reactions out of nowhere? That's fascinating. Anyway.
Promise we're not that media illiterate. I'm sure if I watched it, I could figure out something.
You watch Americans walking around Britain and they're just permanently confused because nobody says what they mean. They ask directions to the station and they don't don't understand the answers. They're just lost.
Well, yeah, the signs are giving you hints and not the truth.
There's that meme, isn't there? Or that sort of that viral thing that goes around every now and again when you know, you get somebody from, it's usually America, sort of saying, oh, the British person said that, you know, I'd done quite well on a thing, and that feels like really, really good praise. And everyone from England is like, oh dear, you know, they hate you.
Well, it's like I occasionally have meetings with American people for various things, and I've gotten into the habit of saying at the start of the call, by the way, I am very excited about this project and I'm really keen to work on it. I know I'm not expressing that, but that's because I'm British. And I find
I have
that's really helpful.
British face.
Yeah, yeah. Because otherwise they literally get to the end and they're like, well, yeah, okay, well, never mind. And I'm like, no. Yeah, especially with like LA people. Anyway, sorry, yes. There really was a question.
No, but, it's that was my bad. I tangented us. So I would say that it depends very much on the project as to the approach that you take. So if you were localizing a game about where the location itself was vital to, you know, like a sense of place, because it is really important that it is set in Victorian London, or it's really important that it is set in New Orleans in the 50s or something, you know, it's so those parts you'd be like, okay, well, I need you to have this historical context, and you can translate it in terms of direct translation mostly, but do not change, you know, the facts, don't change the, you know, the positioning of these historical temples, because they're really important to the sense, and it is telling a story that is so tied to a local location, that's the word I'm looking for, that you wouldn't want it to be stripped of those parts. And so you would talk to the localizing team, or you would stress that in the overview of the project that you give to them. With Monsters Expedition, it was far more about the sense of playful wonder, and there is a sort of, okay, it takes place in essentially a caricature of England, specifically England rather than Britain as well. And so feel free to play with that as the stereotype however you have it from your perspective. It's this sort of twee land of gingham and, you know, the Great British Bake Off and so forth. But, you know, the important part wasn't always that. It needs to be a consistent place. It is rooted in this quite saccharine but funny but weird national stereotype. Not saccharine, it can be saccharine if you look at the top layer, and then everything is so weird and passive aggressive or like not communicated directly that they hit each other in interesting ways and generate really interesting friction to me. And I wanted to make sure that came across, so I went through all of the objects and explained the joke, but I also wanted to just make sure that I laid out what part of the object was funny, you know, it was so, or funny to me, you know, hope it landed. But so there were things.
Can you give a specific example of that, just in case people haven't played the game or
can't
remember?
So I'm just trying to think. The one that came to my mind was the there's an exercise bike object in the game, and I haven't got the document in front of me, but I think it's called like a laundry rack in the game. And so the point there is that a lot of people will buy one intending to exercise, and then it just just gradually or less gradually becomes somewhere that you hang washing when it's rainy outside. Right. And so that, I think I you know, so you say in the little, in the very much expanding rapidly box next to that small piece of text that you're having localized, that, okay, well, this is the object. I include a picture of that so they can actually picture what they're working with. I would say it's the joke here is this. It's about, you know, people's assumptions about their future self and how that really, really doesn't tend to have any bearing on their future self becoming their present self and realizing, oh no, here I am. And so what they then chose to take from that, at least they've got the sense of where the humor of the object is. They might call the bike something different. They might say that it's a slightly different thing than a laundry rack. You know, those things bother me at all. There are objects where, again, I wish that I had the spreadsheet in front of me, but where I was... I'm totally fine if they changed the joke, actually, but I wanted it to still be consistent with the playfulness, with the fact that these monsters who are looking at these objects and trying to curate them and make sense of them always get them slightly wrong. So
I feel like the exercise bike example is really good, because I guess the joke part there is that the monster is misinterpreting the object, but actually... is more correct than we are, in that like they look at the exercise bike and they see the truth of the laundry rack beyond the veneer of the exercise bike. So if you take that to another culture where perhaps it doesn't rain all the time and laundry is not an issue, then like you want to be encouraging that sense of finding the true thing behind it, whatever that might be, rather than sort of explicitly explaining that it rains in Britain and drying laundry is a real pain, because that's a whole load of baggage to get.
So in that particular instance, I think, if memory serves, there was actually some clothing drying on the rack that was actually, you know, made it explicitly British. But if we'd chosen not to do that, like you say, I would have been totally fine with the translations just saying, oh, it's where you store your magazines, you know, in that country it was far more common for the joke to be that you've piled up your magazines on the seat or something like that, or you use it to lean your DIY against or something like that, you know, those.
Yeah, the key being that it's not used for exercise, right? Like that's
basically
the key.
Yeah, it's the joke, or the thing that I want to carry through is the laughing at humans sort of lofty goals for themselves. Ambitions, and how that plays out, you know. So those things are what I choose to focus on there. And then you've also just got the very direct things where you just want the player to know that this is how you jump in the game. And it's like, I was actually just responding to something where sometimes the localizers will also get the text completely out of context. So there was a button press interaction, and the prompt that it gave you was one that I hadn't used before. It was copy, because I wanted, or the character was going to mimic something. And the note I got back was, what sense is this word? This, you know, I've just got the word copy in front of me. That could mean a whole bunch of things. It could also be a noun. It could be, you know, like, what is this? And I'm like, okay, it's a imperative verb. And I'm looking at John's face just there, but well, this is the thing though. I was like, what is that word for when it's like a command? Yeah. So I had to imperative, because I was just like, why does my brain not have these things in? And I did read, like, I hope this isn't an urban legend, because it's been making me feel better for years, but there was a whole sort of tranche of time in the UK education system where they where the approach was that we would learn grammar through kind of just vibes, or through ambient sort of paying attention. Picking it up just by being speakers immersed in the language. And so there are things that, you know, my young relatives do, like diagramming sentences or whatever. And I'm like, we never did that. What's this?
No, well, Michael Gove brought in this move towards very pedagogical grammar teaching, and my kids have gone through it, and it's utterly, utterly awful. And they just spend their whole time on these things called fronted adverbials, which are just essentially made up, as far as I can tell. And like, there's no love of language in it, and it's a disaster.
Quite sassy, though.
I mean, it's a sort of pretense at intellectualism to cover for the fact that they didn't actually know what to put in the national curriculum. But this is not a politics podcast, so we'd better move along.
Fair. But yeah, so that was... but yes, so to go back to that example of copy, I was kind of... I then had to think, okay, yes, no, it is intended as this imperative. You need to know that it is the verb form. I will also give you the context that it is for imitating an action that you see in the world. So, you know, if mimic works better for you conceptually, or, you know, if those are some acceptable synonyms in English. So if that helps you think around this problem from whichever language you're coming from, then those are some other clues that will hopefully lead to the correct meaning being transferred in this very tiny prompt that just marries to a single button press.
No, but it's a good example, because this is the amount of thought is required for things that you might just whip off as a writer in your native language. You don't think about it that much because you're like, this is what's happening. And then suddenly you work with a UI designer who's like, well, we have to design for this like pixel width in all the different languages it might be. Do you really need to have the name be this far? Could you like slightly swap what that is? Actually, your example of the exercise bike is fabulous, because yeah, even for my family, this was like such an issue, because it wasn't just that you need space to be drying your laundry, but the implication that an average household does not have a drying machine in this country. Well, through my parents for a loop, they had no idea like how you would do it. They're like, if it's that humid in this country and wet all the time, isn't it even worse? Right? Isn't it even more necessary to do this? And they are not wrong, because everyone has this drying rack, and you're just sitting here being like, is it dry enough to not turn bad or what? No one knows. Every other day you check, right? So this is a perfect
example.
There's
also a point where if you are having that kind of a time, or you are neurodiverse, where it essentially just becomes an extra clothes storage. Like, the thing will be bone dry, and you're like, well, I could transfer it to some drawers, but also I could just get dressed straight from the rack. So
yes,
I
totally
guess.
And then on top of that, like, why is your drying bike
is wearing a tuxedo in the corner of the room, better dressed than you are.
Exactly, my plus one for the BAFTAs.
Yes, and this other very British thing: why is it in the kitchen? Oh, what? Because that's where our machines are. Why are they there? Why would you put dirty clothes where you have your food? No one knows, but this is what we do here. Anyway.
It's so that your clothes can smell wonderful of dinner. Oh,
your freshly cleaned sheets that are still a bit damp, so they'll absorb all of the
might smell
the flavors.
Like hot cross buns at the moment. Thank you.
Right. So I do have a real question, and that is that this is a tremendous amount of effort. All of these things, right? This takes a lot of work, and it's, well, let's say it takes a lot of work to do well. In the way that you're describing, Pip, right? Like this back and forth with the localizers and understanding of who they are, what they're going to. You obviously can't do this for every language on the planet, right? So there's almost always some subset of languages, but it might be quite large, right? It might be a team of 10 localizers working on your project. How do you know if it works? How do you know if this effort was worthwhile? Because this is actually harder, I think, than it might seem. Because, well, for one thing, even if you get a reviewer reviewing your game on a video games website from another country, let's say, it is not uncommon for those games journalists, as you yourself will know, Pip, to be themselves fluent in English and may choose to play in English anyway because they want to get the original experience, right? So you're sort of resorting to Steam reviews that are themselves written in another language, which you can sort of filter here and there for like what their setting is set to. This is a very difficult way of knowing whether these things work or not, right? I mean, how do you know? How do you know?
So I think sometimes you won't know if it went well, but you'll know if it went badly, if that makes sense. So I think that if translations are repeatedly being thrown up as inaccurate or if the game vibe feels off, then that will be feedback that will make it back to you, especially if it's holding true for multiple people. So that feels like a thing that you will find out. I'm going to plug another podcast just for a second, very rudely, because I dug into specifically the Monsters Expedition stuff with Alan, who runs Dragneck, and Soren, producer on that project, as well as multiple other things around Dragneck and the Think Games space. And we dug into a bunch of feedback, I think, that Soren got about like the translations being good or like making her laugh and you know, all of that kind of thing. I'm not multilingual, another failure of the British education system, and me. So I can't often figure that stuff out myself to any great degree. I will say actually that Twitch streams are really interesting on that front, right, because you can then see if someone's laughing at the point where you know there's a joke in there. You know, you can see if they are emoting in the way that you would hope for or expect, or if the, for example, with Kitty, you can kind of see if a joke has connected, or if they think that a particular character is adorable, or they've noticed a particular touch that you included in the dialogue that would hopefully connect with them. So I would actually say that those can be some lovely, they're qualitative, and obviously it takes ages to sit through and to pick those up. So it's again, and it's very much after the fact, so it's a hard thing to then generalize from, but you can definitely see if somebody has connected with the things that you were hoping for, because their face will tell you, and the audience reaction in the chat will sometimes also pop off in ways that you're like, I know that icon, I know those sort of, you know, spam type moments, you know, I know the thing that has happened is supposed to happen, good.
I guess the reality is that actually it's quite difficult for us as writers to get much feedback on the individual impact of lines that we're writing in our games. Anyway, like, reviews will sometimes say top line things like, oh, the writing is good, but usually they won't ever say the writing is serviceable, when 90% of all game writing only wants to be serviceable. You know, funny, nice, effective, basically characterized, but there's not that many games which really want the writing to be a standout feature, because a lot of the time we want it to just get out of the way so you can get on with the game successfully. Perhaps less so in the games that we collaboratively work on, but still across the board. And then, yeah, because I found myself watching Twitch streams to try and understand if people are connecting with the writing. But I often find, even just in English, that they're so busy doing whatever else is going on, they very rarely stop and go, oh, that was a nice turn of phrase. You know, I guess if you're writing comedy, then you've got that more immediate reaction to gauge. That's helpful, I suppose.
Is this a family-friendly podcast? What age rating are we aiming for here?
That's a good question.
90-year-olds only.
Yeah, I think of it as being like mostly useful for students and kind of younger professionals. So,
okay.
Go on.
It's not the big swears or anything. I'm not going to suddenly, you know, mask off or anything. It's that one of the moments that reliably would sort of get streamers is in Little Kitty. There's a moment where the Shiba dog that has surprised you from a hedge tells you that he has lost his balls, and you know, it's just sort of very deadpan, and I was looking for plausible deniability in that moment, but you know, people do react to it, and so watching people sort of like fully crease up in that moment has been rewarding. Because I think the game presents itself as so wholesome, and that isn't
unwholesome, to twist it,
but it's a kind of, it's not going to be a totally frictionless world, or it's going to be a world that sort of has a sense of, I don't know, a sense of humour that hopefully cuts across a few layers, and it can just be a, like, there's no quite response often, from a kid. It's like, you know, yeah, they've lost their balls. It's fine.
There's humour in just sort of having a boundary that you assume is a boundary and then crossing that boundary. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's, that is a moment of an obvious reaction that you can, I guess, look and treat as a benchmark. So this isn't necessarily related to those things, but something that I realised I wanted to ask you, John, was you were talking, you were sort of saying at the start about this, I guess, your relationship with localization, but something
that's a strong word for it.
Came to my head was that something like Heaven's Fall, like, do you feel like that was a game of localization, essentially, of making sense of these pieces of text, of translating? Like, do you think that you were using similar skills in some ways to think about that back and forth?
I think I probably should have done more, actually, is the honest answer. Like, there were certain aspects in the language design where we were thinking about kind of what's the culture behind this and how do they write and how do they talk and what's an important reference point for them, and that, you know, that sort of stuff was really valuable. So things like the word for value is based around the symbol for water, right? Because that tells you a huge thing about the world immediately. That's a great thing, and we try to do that as much as we possibly could.
Salary is salt, right? And so we do something similar.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly. An amazing example. I remember we at the time we used to go on about how it was built off German, because did you know the word for hedgehog in German is spike pig? And then I was telling this to a journalist at some point, and I suddenly stopped halfway through the sentence and thought, hedgehog.
Yeah.
Oh god. Just bloody hell. Okay. Turns out I know English less well than I know German. but I think that kind of one thing I was thinking about when you were describing earlier about the process of localizing like short snippets for buttons, and I was thinking about how we don't do any localization really at Inkle, but we end up going through that kind of process quite a lot anyway, when especially thinking about buttons, when you're labeling a button, we have these long arguments about should this button be confirm, or is that too formal, or accept, or is that too passive, or like okay, or like just even things that are out of world, and then things that are in world, like we're always arguing about, is this button called the notebook or the journal or the memorial or the make a note or the how active should this verb be? And it's exactly that conversation of how much association and information do we want to pack into this one single word, because people are going to look at it a lot and they need to connect with it immediately, which is kind of it's frustrating when you're doing it because you can never quite get it right. But
you've got
it's
a glorious that language open in is so many sorry. Tabs.
But isn't it amazing that language can do this? That like a single word is a whole suitcase full of stuff that you're giving to people. And then, you know, we as writers, our job is literally to line up suitcase after suitcase after suitcase after suitcase for the maximum impact. Like, no wonder we're all going bonkers the whole time. Like, the sheer amount of stuff that you're trying to pack into these tiny little containers all the time is really kind of overwhelming when you stop to think about it, which is why I think one of the reasons why I don't want to have to stop to think about it too much. I'd rather just get on with it. I like drop the script and leave, please. But you know, obviously like not everyone has that freedom, let alone desire. But I do remember, just to finish on Heaven's Vault, there were a couple of places where, and the community delights in pointing these out to me every time they find one, where I've accidentally translated something in English using the wrong thing. So there is a wedding band you can find in the game where the slogan on it is "Your heart in mine," which is beautiful, right? Except I translated mine as the place underground where you get rocks from. And obviously we did this because it's a semi-procedural system and I didn't even stop to think about it at the time, because one spreadsheet and the other spreadsheet, I wasn't comparing the two. In the end, we left it in because I thought, fine, it's a wedding band that's just really creepy. Like, that's just what it is.
Maybe there's storied explanation of that, like that you could actually build like a short story out of, you know, why it meant something to that person,
exactly,
or if it was an in-joke, or
but But do the fans do that? Do they do that, Pip? Or do they just go, no, we found a bug? And no amount of me saying, that's not a bug, it's a feature, and I've left it in deliberately for the last 6 years because, yeah, it doesn't fly.
I remember, like, I used to write just a blog to update people on what was going on behind the scenes when I used to work at Digital Spy. Like, I was, you know, it was very much, hey, we had these people from X Factor in the office. No, they weren't the winners, obviously. Like, we had these other people, you know, and sort of making it a fun story, all of that stuff. I have never had so many comments as when I spelled restaurateur wrong. And I'm like, thanks. Thanks for your engagement. It's registering as engagement. I'm just going to take the win.
I love this. I love this. I feel that a debate about spelling is the perfect place to end a podcast about localization. So thank you very, very much, Pip, for joining us for all of this time. There's so much that we can talk about, not just in this topic, but clearly in all of the different ways that you've intersected with the industry. So thank you for your time. We will stop there. Listeners, please join us next week when we open up the book again and find a new article from the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope. Take care. Bye.
Bye.